The leisure side of Iran, today on The World. I'm Jeb Sharp. Our own Marco Werman is in Tehran, and today he explores what residents of Iran's capital do for fun.
I'm in a cable car heading up to the Tolchal ski slopes, and I'm going to go to the top and just try and find out what is this side of Tehran all about.
Also, reaction to the ceasefire deal for Syria hammered out by Russia and the U.S. This Syrian opposition member is skeptical.
For starters, no Syrians were present at the table.
Plus, the real Canadian chef behind a popular fake chef on Instagram.
Having a lot of followers on Instagram is sort of like being rich in Monopoly. Like, it doesn't really mean anything. I'm very happy that I got to make a lot of people laugh.
That's all coming up here on The World. First, we want to get to some potentially promising news about Syria. It happened at a peace conference in Germany. The U.S. and Russia announced they've agreed to implement a nationwide cessation of hostilities in Syria in a week's time. And humanitarian aid to Syrians under siege is supposed to start immediately. There was also a striking statement from Iran's foreign minister. He said his country is prepared to work with arch-rival Saudi Arabia to bring about stability in Syria. Earlier, I spoke with Amr al-Azam, who's a member of Syria's opposition. He teaches Middle Eastern history at Shawnee State University in Portsmouth, Ohio. So, Amr, are you celebrating?
What? What are we supposed to celebrate? We welcome, obviously, any efforts to halt the violence or any efforts to reduce the impact of the Russian bombing or, more importantly, deliver aid, food aid and supplies to the besieged areas. But I just don't see how this is going to really come about.
What are you worried about? I mean, what do you see on paper?
For starters, let's put it this way. No Syrians were present at the table. The main people who are essentially overseeing this and involved in the actual bombing have essentially excluded themselves from the ceasefire. So as far as the Americans are concerned, they will continue to bomb what they consider to be ISIL. The Russians have always essentially officially said that they're bombing terrorists, and they have excluded terrorists from the ceasefire. So they're going to continue to bomb the way they are. And the Syrian regime has just announced that it is also not bound by the ceasefire. So who's to be bound by the ceasefire? And of course, al-Nusra, Jan, and ISIL are not going to be bound by the ceasefire. They're not part of this, obviously. So who's going to be bound by the ceasefire? I mean, who's the ceasefire aimed at?
Is it possible, Amr, to have a ceasefire where you continue to bomb ISIL and al-Nusra Front, the al-Qaeda surrogates?
Not really. ISIL is fairly contained in its own area. So theoretically, yes, you can continue the war against ISIL if you're only going to target ISIL in their own areas. But the as far as the Russians are concerned, and this was very clear in the Russian sort of communique, that they are going to continue to bomb, that this would exclude Jabhat al-Nusra, and they were going to continue their war on terror. What is likely to happen is that we're going to see not a de-escalation, but an intensification of Russian bombing in the week leading up to the supposed beginning of the ceasefire, in the hope of trying to sort of even grab more territory. We may then see a slight decrease or maybe a slight respite, but that will pick up again right away. In fact, the Russians were bombing around northern Homs today.
Help us with this moment. We've been reading about just the incredible crisis in Aleppo and just terrible images of suffering and flight and bombing. And we've been talking to you for a long time now about Syria.
Yes.
Can you characterize or crystallize the moment and how much Aleppo plays into these talks?
I mean, Aleppo what people maybe aren't aware of is that Aleppo is a huge city. It's not just huge in size in that it originally had a population of, over 5 million inhabitants, but it's also historically very important. It was considered to be the industrial center of Syria. It was also historically considered to be the one of the longest continuously inhabited cities in the world. And it's a city that is listed as a World Heritage Site. So, you know, the death of a city like Aleppo is not just the death of any city. It is really tearing out the heart and soul of you're tearing out a huge piece of what is essentially Syria and what identifies Syria as Syria. And what I see is a city that is essentially being destroyed piece by piece. And I think that's what the Russians will do, at least in the areas that are outside regime control. They are now going to intensify their bombardment. They're going to drive what is left of the inhabitants there out. And there will be nothing left for those defenders to stay and defend. And they would be forced to leave too. And then the regime would have this hollow victory in that, yes, they regained control of Aleppo, but there's no Aleppo left to control.
So just to wrap up then, Amr, it's your opinion that no one coming out of this Munich conference should be saying peace in our time?
I don't think so. Not with what we have in hand. I don't see it. I think the most optimistic statements that I've heard coming out of Munich are, let's wait and see how this translates itself. It really, but I'm not optimistic at all.
Amr al-Azam teaches Middle Eastern history at Shawnee State University in Ohio. He's also a member of the Syrian opposition. Thank you.
Thank you.
Now to Marco in Tehran. Yesterday, he took us to a rally commemorating Iran's Islamic Revolution. It's a big holiday there. But today, he tells us about a different side of Iran, one we don't usually get to see. He's with the world's Matthew Bell and their interpreter, and I'll let him explain.
Well, this is certainly a different scene from yesterday's political rally celebrating the 37th anniversary of the revolution. This is also a rally of sorts, but this is a rally to the top of the mountains just to the north of Tehran. I'm in a cable car heading up to the Tulchal ski slopes. There are a few women I saw earlier hiking up in chadors. I don't think we're going to see them skiing. But instead of placards with the pictures of the Ayatollahs on them today, people are coming up here with snowboards, with ski poles, with skis. And I'm going to go to the top and just try and find out what is this side of Tehran all about. Well, we're reaching the summit of Tulchal, the mountain where everybody goes skiing, and the views are unbelievably dramatic. Steep slopes. There's a wind blowing across. I don't know if you can hear that. And behind me, if I turn around, magnificent views of Tehran. It's just a part of its country that you just never think about. There go a couple of young ladies in a cable car going back down the mountain. They seem to have some music going, or they're dancing. Crazy.
Hello.
Do you speak English? I'm here with Mohammed on the top of Mount Tulchal. Just to the north of Iran. Mohammed, you're all bundled up. You're ready to do a little skiing today. You got the goggles on. Yes. You're completely bundled up. It's very windy up here. Let me just ask you, how long have you been skiing?
4 years.
You have a lot of friends who ski with you?
Yes, of course. My friends is in hotel right now.
Oh, okay. So are you from Tehran?
Yes.
Yeah. But is there a hotel somewhere around here?
Yes, the Tulchal Hotel is at the bottom of the list.
So they're going to join you a little bit later, are they?
Yes, of course.
So tell me, is skiing becoming more popular in Iran?
No.
It's not?
Not popular.
It's not popular.
No. But because why? Expensive.
Yeah.
Expensive sports.
Do you see a few more people coming out, though?
Now, much better than 5 years ago. And younger people come for skiing much than older. Yes.
Great. Thank you very much, Mohammed.
You're welcome.
Have a great
day.
Have fun.
Thank you.
So I'm in the Tulchal Ski School Lodge. It's a tight little stone building right on top of the mountain, out of the wind. I'm with Shadi. She's from Tehran in a ski suit. Do you come here a lot?
One time in 1 week.
There are some great skiing places in the United States. Switzerland is also great for skiing. What's so great about skiing here in Iran? Okay, that's okay.
He wants us to stop recording?
Stop recording.
So back in the cable car, heading back down Mount Tochal to the base. Really kind of a shame that we couldn't stay on the top and speak with a few more people, but the head at the ski lodge there got on his walkie-talkie and wanted us to get more permission, even though we thought we had been properly accredited to speak to people. A couple of comments that one skier made at the end there I thought were really kind of right on, and that is skiing is an expensive sport, and not a lot of people in Tehran have the money to afford even a $10 lift ticket. I mean, there are some signs that the economy could be improving with sanctions getting lifted. So far, a couple of the people that we spoke with said they haven't seen a real increase in numbers of skiers, if that's any gauge of how the economy is doing right now. But who knows? Maybe more sanctions will get lifted and we'll see more people out here on the slopes. For the world, Marco Werman heading back down Mount Tochal in a cable car here in Iran.
The world's reporting team in Tehran, Marco and producer Matthew Bell, took some photos of their day on the slopes. We posted a few of their Instagram pics at PRI.org, and you'll be hearing more Iran stories from Marco and Matthew all next week here on The World. Okay, you can't avoid it. Valentine's Day is coming up this weekend, so we thought we'd take a moment to talk about dating websites. They're popular all over, but it turns out that smartphone apps for dating are having a more dramatic impact in certain parts of the world. Take a listen.
Apps are opening up a whole new world of opportunity for young people in India.
That's the BBC's Simon Mabin. He's done a radio documentary on dating apps around the world, and he's been asking people all over how they're using these apps, including in places where families have a big say in who you date.
At the moment, it's highly educated urbanites, young urbanites. First of all, they can take control of who they end up with. So rather than their parents or another relative deciding for them, they're actually deciding for themselves, and that's incredibly empowering.
It doesn't hurt that an app on a phone in your pocket can be a lot more private than a website on a shared computer at home. In much of the world, it's not just sites like Tinder or Grindr that people are turning to. Simon found that in Latin America, Badoo is more popular. In Russia, it's something called Frim. In Saudi Arabia, the most downloaded app is Who's Here. That app offers anonymity. But there are definitely risks, and the risks can be even higher for gay people in countries where same-sex relationships are forbidden. Mabin spoke to one man in Kenya who asked to be called John. John used a dating app to meet with a man for sex, only to find out he'd been set up.
They started getting it on, they took off each other's clothes. 5 minutes later, two guys burst in the door, start shouting at them very aggressively, saying, "You're gay, you're disgusting," and they were asking for money. He feared for his life.
John managed to escape, but says he's still traumatized by what happened. Of course, the most common concern about the rise of the dating apps is that they're changing our attitudes about relationships. But Mabin's not so sure about that.
There's a bit of scaremongering going on that happens when anything new comes onto the scene. Maybe it's slightly easier and quicker to get casual sex using Tinder, but I don't think we'll see people giving up on marriage and long-term stable relationships because of it. I think that's part of much broader social change than just dating apps.
That's the BBC's Simon Mabin. I'm Jeb Sharp, and you're tuned to The World. Imtithal Mahmoud is a senior at Yale. Her family is from Sudan, Darfur specifically, a region of Sudan where war has been raging on and off now for over a decade. Here in the U.S., Mahmoud's been making a name for herself on the poetry slam circuit, and her poems are often about the war back home.
Ivory when the sun hits bone at high noon. Burgundy when blood dries. It chips as if it's trying to escape back into a body. I can never forget how much death loves my people, the way they fall asleep at his feet. Burgundy blankets, burgundy pillows, but our tears are colorless. There is no hue to shade this pain.
Emmy Mahmoud left Sudan with her family when she was just a baby. She grew up mostly in Philadelphia. But when she was 7, the family returned to Darfur for an extended visit. While they were there, the government stopped paying teachers. Mahmoud remembers the day the adults in her family went to protest the shutdown of the schools.
the kids, we were at home and we saw the smoke rising from downtown, which is where our parents and aunts and uncles had gone to protest. And then we hear screaming and everyone is running back toward the villages, back toward their homes. And I remember there were these two schoolgirls older than I and my sister and cousins were. They came and they knocked on our door, and when we opened it, it was very scary because they said to us, "We need to hide now. They're coming." And we said, "Who are coming?" And they said, "The soldiers." And we just had no idea what to do. So all of us just ran inside into the bedroom and hid underneath the bed. So our family members came home with blood on them, and they all looked very devastated because, as I got older, I found out more and more why it is they looked so devastated. Not because the schools stayed closed for longer, but because this government killed people for a protest, for protesting.
Can you, having witnessed these things and gone back and forth and lived the life you've lived, is there a way to say how this experience affects the way you see the world, not just Darfur?
Yeah. This might sound funny, but you would expect people who have gone through such trying experiences to have a very negative view of the world. But the reality is that the people who were around me during this time, they have such a positive view of the world. Something that sticks out right away is how we used to have breakfast in Sudan. There would be warplanes flying overhead, so you couldn't really hear anybody talk. But we would be sitting there, and it would be wonderful to be around your family in that moment. And the faces we would make and the ways we would communicate when we couldn't speak over the airplanes, and the jokes that my aunts and uncles would make in between the planes. I remember even my cousin one time, he said, "Oh, look," he saw me look up at the plane. I looked up and I looked a little bit scared, I'm assuming, because I saw two planes flying overhead. They always fly in pairs. It's very strange. And he was just like, "Wow, that guy is still chasing the other guy? Man, I thought he caught him already." And he made a joke about it and we kind of laughed it off. And in that way, you try to create some kind of stability in such an unstable time.
That's great. Thank you for helping us see that. It just brought a smile to my face. I would love you to read from your poem, Mama. This is the poem that won you the Individual World Poetry Slam Championship last year. Can you tell us a little bit about how you came to write it and then read us a bit of it?
It's mostly about my mother on the surface. But the reality is the things that I learned from her, she learned from her mother and she from her mother before her. So I called it Mama and made it about my mom. But the reality is it's about the women in my family and the women in my life. When I was 7, my mama cradled bullets in the billows of her robes. That same night, she came home and taught me how to get gunpowder out of cotton with a bar of soap. Years later, when the sons of soldiers held her at gunpoint and asked her who she was, she said, "I am a woman. I am a daughter of Adam. Who the hell are you?" And the last time we went home, we watched our village burn. Soldiers pouring blood from civilian skulls as if they too could turn water into wine. The woman who raised me turned and said, "Don't be scared. I'm your mother. I'm here. I won't let them through." My mama gave me conviction. Women like her inherit bruised wrists, tired eyes, and titanium-plated spines. The daughters of widows wearing the wings of amputees, they carry countries between their shoulder blades. Thank you.
Oh, thank you for reading that. We need to wrap up, but I wanted to ask you, you got the chance to meet with President Obama last week. What was the occasion, and what did you tell him?
I got a call from the White House, and I was invited to participate in this roundtable discussion with President Obama, and of course I was over the moon. It was for his visit to the Baltimore Mosque, the Baltimore Islamic Society. We were brought there to talk to him about our experiences and about just everything. It's a very all-encompassing kind of conversation. I focused on internalized oppression.
Did you tell him anything specific about that, about breaking through that, or how it relates to what he's been saying?
And the conversation was actually off the record. And
fair enough.
That's why I was sharing in general what I said, but not specifically just yet.
Let me ask you this. Does it feel like an exciting time? I mean, in one way, identities are really up right now in the national conversation. That could mean you're sort of put in a box as the, you know, the kid from Darfur. On the other hand, it may connect you with all kinds of other people on all these other issues. What does the moment feel like to you?
I think the moment is a pretty brilliant moment because, yes, I'm a kid from Darfur, but I'm also a kid from Philly, which is very important. That intersection of those experiences links me to a lot of people. And at the same time, I'm also a kid that's graduating from Yale in a few months. And so that gives me a platform that a lot of people who go through what I went through don't have. It's something that you can use to help others get to where you are. I think who I am and what I do have combined in a very beautiful way.
That's really, really wonderful. And it sounds like your audiences really share that feeling too. Emmy Mahmoud is a writer, poetry slam champion, global health researcher, and senior at Yale. Thanks so much, Emmy.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
And you're listening to The World. I'm Jeb Sharp. Coming up, what it means when interest rates go below zero. Plus, we meet the guy who keeps the subway trains in Sweden's capital running on time, even in the middle of winter.
No disruptions.
No.
Not one.
No.
Not one at all.
No.
How he does that, ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Jeb Sharp, and this is The World. Normally, when somebody lends you money, you have to pay for it. That's the way it works in much of the world. But now some countries are taking some pretty drastic measures to spur their economies. Sweden, Japan, and the European Central Bank are cutting interest rates just below zero. It's called negative interest, which is kind of hard to grasp. So I asked Charles Kane of MIT's Sloan School of Management to explain what negative interest is exactly and who's paying it.
It really refers to the commercial banks that are holding money with the central banks of those countries. Normally, the central banks would be required to pay interest on that money. However, the central banks are trying to encourage their commercial banks to lend that money out. So they're penalizing them with negative interest.
If the changes are so tiny, like a tenth of a percent, and I'm a big bank, do I care?
Absolutely. A tenth of a percent on billions of dollars adds up. And it could be the difference of profit or loss in a major commercial bank.
What's your assessment of this? Are you worried about it?
I'm not worried about it. I think what I do worry about is they're running out of ways in which to get an economy going. First, it was quantitative easing. And that was something very dramatic relative to what anyone ever did in history, which is, in addition to lowering interest rates, you start printing money. Now, what happened in Europe is the quantitative easing didn't work. It wasn't enough to spur on their economy. So they went one level even further. I honestly don't know what another step could be other than negative interest rates.
How low can negative interest rates go?
How low can they go? I think until the value of oil starts to at least stabilize, it's going to be a guessing game as to how low it can go.
Are we likely to see it happen here?
Janet Yellen yesterday said that it's not off the table, is the way she put it. And what's interesting is she's going in the other direction, and she's talking about still increasing rates in the U.S. But I think based on her comments yesterday, she's going in the other direction a lot slower and reassessing where the global market is, because the global market is not at the targets in which they thought it would be at this stage. So I don't think she wants to do this in any way. I think she's very much against it. However, she may be forced into it, not so much because of interest rates, because of foreign exchange rates. If the dollar continues to climb relative to these other currencies, our exports will continue to decline.
So it's a very
It's a real balancing act, and it's everything is relative. Everything is relative.
Against this backdrop, what does the consumer need to know?
Well, the consumer here is actually in a good position, because as prices go down, as rates go down, people are more able to buy homes, people are more able to buy cars, and so on. And the governments of the world are trying to do everything possible to encourage buying behavior.
Can I just say, we had this crash, the economy started to come back, then the markets got all jittery and the price of oil dropped. Now we're in this bit where it almost sounds sort of desperate. Countries are mm-hmm. going to negative rates. But you make it sound as if it could work. It just has to stay in balance because the currencies can get out of whack.
Yeah. And it could work if given the chance to work. One of the things that the markets don't like is volatility. They don't like indecision and changes. What they want is a clear path to what you're trying to do, which is why Janet Yellen keeps saying, we are going to maintain our position on raising rates over time. The market can absorb that. The market can understand that and react to it. But then if you whiplash and do something different, the markets get jittery, they get unstable, and what you see is an incredibly defensive market where people just don't want to hold on, they just want to sell.
Charles Kane, thank you for talking money with us.
It's been my pleasure to be here.
Charles Kane with MIT's Sloan School of Management. We're heading into a frigid weekend here in Boston, but this winter is nowhere near as rough as the one we had last year. We got about 9 feet of snow over 6 weeks. Roads were impassable, the trains broke down, it felt like we ground to a halt. Well, it snows a lot in Stockholm, too, but that city just keeps on going. So we sent the world's Jason Margolis to Sweden to find out what they're doing right.
If I ever start a company, first person I'm hiring is this guy.
Soren Stark.
He works for Structon Rail, a city contractor. His job description is literally to make the trains run on time, and subways. When he got the job a few years back, he took things very seriously.
The first year, I go to sleep 2 o'clock in the morning because I want to look at the forecast, wake up 4 o'clock.
He told me he drinks 10 cups of coffee a day, by the way. But his sleep deprivation did pay off. Stark showed me a lot of data and graphs. He pulled up one for rail performance last winter.
No disruption?
No disruptions?
No.
Not one?
No.
Not one at all?
No. No.
At this point, I'm thinking Structon Rail is using some seriously amazing technology. Aerodynamic plows or snow-eating robots? Nope. It basically comes down to preparation.
Our goal is to we find it before it breaks. We also practice that the machines and the organization work.
Doesn't it cost a lot of money to practice?
Yes, but you need to practice. You need to know that everything is working. It's like you are going to the dentist every year.
He shows me the data. Every time he has to take a train out of commission, it's a much bigger dent in his budget. Preparation also begins months before winter arrives, trimming branches and clearing leaves in fall. But he's telling me all of this in an office with PowerPoint. I rode the subway and trains for 9 days in the dead of winter. There wasn't that much snow, but still the trains always showed up exactly on time. And if you miss your ride, there's another one 2 to 4 minutes behind. Okay, Stockholm, you've convinced me. But what about your roads? I went to Trafikkontoret, the city agency that manages Stockholm's streets. Peter Ringkrenz unfolds a map of the city.
I'll show you here.
Yep.
You can look here. This is this area. And the red streets will be finished in 2 hours after when it starts snowing.
I'm starting to get it. The key is to be hyper-organized. But what about when there's just too much snow? Rinkren's colleague Suzanne Peterson takes on that one.
This sidewalk is used for snow storage for the rest of the winter. Pedestrians are advised to use the cleared and sanded sidewalk on the other side of the street.
So one side of the street,
you're walking,
the other side is snow.
Yes.
It's just so logical that you want to scream. They also dump a lot of snow in the Baltic Sea after they clean it and grind it up. But what about the epic blizzard, like the one a few weeks ago that shut down New York and Washington? I asked, doesn't Stockholm shut down then?
No, it never shuts down.
It's never happened. The bus is going all day.
Trains check, roads check. Now we're really going to put Stockholm to the test. Cycling paths. I bundled up and went for a ride with Rigert Andersson. He used to work for the subway and is recently retired.
I cycle all year round. And I've been doing that for like 20 years here in Stockholm.
So you don't mind the cold? How cold does it get here in winter?
No, last week we had like 15 minus Celsius.
That's 5 degrees Fahrenheit.
It's chilly, but you have to put a lot of layers on and be aware of protecting your face, especially.
What about ice and snow on the paths?
Yeah, they clear that every night. So when you go in the morning, it's most of the times well cleaned if it has been snowing.
We'll come back to him in a sec, but I need to correct one point he made. They don't clean every night.
Every day, twice a day, 7 days a week.
Even on days when it's not snowing?
On the days where it's a risk for slippery roads, yeah.
That's Jonas Karlstrom with the city. He shows one of their newest toys, a multi-hog. They're small, one-seat, tractor-like machines that brush away snow and ice. A big tank sprays a saltwater mix. Researchers are studying the proper mixture to get the best friction on about 100 miles of bike paths here. How does it work? Let's go back to the end of my ride with Rigert Andersson.
We made maybe something between 12 and 15 kilometers.
How many patches of ice did we hit during that whole time?
None, actually.
He's right. Stockholm, you win again. For the world, Jason Margolis, Stockholm, world's most efficient city.
One problem in Boston is sometimes our cars get buried in snow. And then they sit there for weeks and weeks. Does that ever happen? You look shocked when
No, it's never happened in Sweden, in Stockholm, no.
I think I'm moving to Sweden. Okay, foodies love a good presentation, but the ingredients at high-end eateries can get a little ridiculous. Maybe that's why Chef Jacques Lamerde rocketed to fame. He photographs meticulously plated dishes with ingredients you'd find at Noma and a truck stop. Think Hostess cupcakes paired with fancy moss. In a year or so, his Instagram account amassed more than 100,000 followers. Most were in on the joke that Chef Jacques Lamerde was a parody, but many were surprised the person behind it was a woman, Chef Christine Flynn. She works at IQ Food Company in Toronto, and her alter ego hits the perfect comedic pitch.
I think I kind of created my own category, which I like to call benevolent satire. It's the kind of thing where you read it and you laugh, but it's not really at the expense of anyone.
Yeah, it's not mean.
No. My mother really likes that element of it.
Do you feel you understand why it had such a reaction? I mean, Lamerde's a star, an Instagram star.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's a little bit, I guess, difficult to wrap my head around it. I, you know, have said over and over again that having a lot of followers on Instagram is sort of like being rich in Monopoly. Like, it doesn't really mean anything. I'm very happy that I got to make a lot of people laugh. But, you know, in terms of it being any kind of like tangible success, like, you know, I mean, I think I came in at a time when the industry was a little bit confused. And I think there's a lot of confusing things going on in the world. And again, I think everyone just needs to laugh every once in a while.
So true. Let's see if we can capture the voice a little bit on the radio. I mean, you pepper the captions with the word bro, and everything is in all caps. Do you have your phone or anything in front of you? Could you kind of
read one.
Capture it for us?
Sure. I mean, it's funny because I think, you know, the minute that you write in all caps, you do really sound like you're yelling and all you're doing is sort of writing in capital letters. But yeah, it certainly is. Hang on, let me pull up a photo here. It certainly is.
Feel free to yell away.
I would never yell at you. I'll pull up my favorite here. So this one is, it's actually a picture of a drumstick on top of like some butterscotch pudding that I've swirled in a circle with some kind of crushed up bits of cake that I got from a gas station. The caption, which was actually based off of real life, was, "Feeling pretty banged up today, bros. Not only did I cut myself real bad on a microplane, but I just got dumped again. Apparently, I'm married to my job and not fun to be around, and also have kind of let myself go." And, you know, it kind of goes on from there to describe the dish in, like, pretty, you know, intense detail, which is one of my favorite parts of the account. But again, it's always these sort of, it's very formulaic. It's this, something bad has happened. You know, Jacques is sort of dealing with it with the help of his like trusty sidekick, Jose. And they always come out sort of on top with a delicious, but also sort of viscerally like repulsive special.
So how close is Christine to Jacques? Is this based on someone else or is it some piece of you?
Oh, no, it's like, this is my real life. Like, this is me cutting myself on a microplane and getting dumped on the same day and being like, you know, I could just sit home and cry or I could just have fun with it and, you know, like, just be a little bit more positive about it. And there's no shortage of material for something like this in kitchens. So really, you know.
How do you go about it? Like, you're in the kitchen. How do you just prepare a Jacques Lemaire dish?
So I actually didn't prepare any of these dishes in my kitchen. I kind of knocked these together like in my living room. So I don't know, I'd be having like a stressful day or something and I'd just swing by a grocery store and, you know, I mean, I typically am one of those people who shops the perimeter. Like I have like a nutrition degree, you know? So I was like, wow, look at all this shiny package stuff. And I'd pick things that were either like really strange to me or sort of made me feel weird when I looked at them. And I'm like, I think I could make something out of this. And I go home and I'd, you know, spend about 5 minutes sort of plating things and tweezering them and making sure I had enough negative space. And I'd sort of write a little caption about either something that had happened that day or maybe something that had happened, you know, at a previous time in my life. And I'd post, you know, it didn't take much time. It was like making a craft.
So do you eat them?
No, typically not.
So where does Jacques Lemaire go next?
I am not totally sure. I mean, I still have some projects I'm working on. But, you know, the big thing for me is I kind of want to just leave him be. I mean, I'm going to do my own career. But there'll never be a moment where there's, like, pictures of, you know, the food I make every day all over that account. Like, I wouldn't do that because I kind of like to believe in the spirit of Jacques, as nutty as I sound. So, like, I think there'll be some plates and some stories every now and again, and I think that's okay. I mean, it's like creating any character, you know? I mean, they kind of take on their own energy.
Christine, so fun to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
That's Chef Christine Flynn. She works at IQ Food Company in Toronto, and she is the person behind the Chef Jacques Lemaire Instagram account. I'm Jeb Sharp, and you're with The World. Pope Francis starts his tour of Mexico today. He'll be getting a huge welcome in Mexico City, in this predominantly Catholic country. But the Pope's not just going to the capital. He's visiting parts of Mexico that have suffered tremendously from the violence of Mexico's drug wars. The World's Monica Campbell is in Mexico City. Monica, what does the itinerary look like? Where is he headed?
Well, it's a really interesting trip, but I just have to note that on his way here in the airplane, there's a photo now already circulating of the Pope wearing one of those huge Mexican sombreros. It looks like he's heading to Cancun, but
it's very fetching.
He's actually going to start his visit in Mexico City. He'll have big gatherings here, and then he'll go to some pretty rough areas around the city. And then he's going to head south to the state of Chiapas, which borders Guatemala. And then he'll wrap his visit in Ciudad Juarez, which is right across from El Paso, where he'll hold mass right there on the U.S.-Mexico border.
That could be quite an emotional moment, given the migration and all the issues.
Absolutely. And I think that's going to be a big theme of his visit. He's actually in some ways following the migrant path. He's going to be in Chiapas, where a lot of people from Central America start their trip. And he's going to end right on the border, where a lot of them, you know, sort of wait and then look for places to cross. I expect that we'll hear the Pope identify with the migrants themselves. And his father was an Italian immigrant who moved to Argentina. He's the first Latin American Pope. I think we'll hear a very clear message of the need to take a humanitarian approach toward immigration. I expect some U.S. politicians will see that as a very politicized part of his trip.
Definitely. And you mentioned the drug violence. How close will he get to what we might think of as dangerous areas?
He'll be very close. He's going to the state of Michoacán, which is a real hotspot for cartels. And then, of course, Ciudad Juárez, until recently, was considered one of the most violent places in the world.
How do you think he sees his role in those areas? How might he address the level of violence?
Let me just repeat, he is the first pope from Latin America. So he comes from Argentina, which, of course, had its own dirty war. He knows what it means to be from a country where thousands of people have been disappeared and missing. And Mexico, of course, is that country as well. So I think he'll be able to speak very intimately about what it means to suffer through these horrible moments in a country for a whole population to feel that.
I imagine he'll provide enormous solace to victims and survivors. Is there more than that? Can he offer anything beyond those words, do anything that could actually change the dynamics?
That's a very interesting point, because when I was in Juarez last week, people are very happy, for the most part, the Pope being there and offering hope that this turning point that city is going through will continue, that he understands their pain. At the same time, the Pope, there is a controversial point here. He's not going to meet with the families of the 43 students who went missing or were killed in the state of Guerrero, which is a very violent state right now. He's not going to meet with the families of those missing students. And a lot of people had hoped that he was going to meet with those families and address how the government has really failed to investigate those murders. But he's backed away. He canceled that meeting. It's hard not to read it as a political maneuver.
So interesting. The World's Monica Campbell speaking to us from Mexico City. Thank you so much, Monica.
You're welcome.
And finally today, let me introduce you to a singer-songwriter who grew up in Mexico. She now lives in San Francisco, and her music is about the struggles in both worlds.
My name is Diana Gameros. I came here to go to college and made a life here. And I know that leaving would mean not being able to come back because of my immigration status.
Mira donde llegaron tus pasos.
My identity, it's not determined by a paper. I'm a human being. And just because a law says that I cannot work, I cannot get a driver's license, I can't go to school, I cannot get financial aid because of my status, that doesn't determine who I am.
Al azul tus pies te llevará. Sigues el susurro de una ola.
This song is called Tus Pasos, and it's a song that was born out of my desire to say, I want to welcome you Syrians, you Mexicans, you Latin Americans, and support them and love them in their journey out of their homes to a new land.
Al azul pacífico llegando.
I think it's important to know people's stories to really connect with what is behind just somebody wanting to come to this country. There's way too much more than, oh, people want to come here for the American dream. There's no such thing as the American dream. People are coming here to feed their children, to be able to provide for them.
El aire tiene olor a que alguien murió. Cierra la puerta, hijito. No quiero escuchar el rito de los
And Juarez is a song that I wrote thinking about mothers. I dedicate it to mothers who have to raise children in violent cities. Every member of my family experienced a particular kind of violence. My father and my sister were pulled out of the car at 2 p.m. with machine guns, and they took their car and were left there on the street. It's been 13 years since I came to the U.S. and haven't been able to go back. But I finally have a visa and will be able to get my permanent residency in 2 years, and will finally be able to go back home and visit.
That's Mexican-born singer Diana Gameros. She told her story to reporter Shuka Kalantari. And you can watch a video of Gameros singing and wandering the streets of San Francisco. It was produced by KQED. Check it out at PRI.org. And that's it for us this week at The World. Our theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Jeb Sharp.
PRI, Public Radio International.